Before Vimes was even able to tap on the window, the door opened and Willikins, immaculate as ever, stepped into the grubby room, all smart and crisp, with shiny shoes and a hint of pomade on his hair. The three men then watched Vimes heave at a likely ring on the floor, which pulled back to reveal the trapdoor to a dark cellar and a ladder going down. Vimes said, "Constable Upshot, I need a little time to think in the darkness. I won't be long." He went down the ladder and pulled the trapdoor closed behind him. The darkness said, "Ah, Commander, at long last, I suspect that you're here to take a witness statement." "This is wrong," Vimes told himself. "How can you take testimony from a demon, especially when it's one of no fixed abode? But on the other hand, who needs a witness statement if you've got a confession?" Up above, Ted Flutter's eyes rolled this way and that as he analysed the situation. "Let's see, we have one young twit who is playing at being a copper, and a snooty butler type, all pink and shiny. I reckon Mrs. Flutter's little boy's out of here." At this point, at this very point, Willikins, without looking at Flutter, reached into his jacket, and there was a slap as he laid down a steel comb on the table in front of him. It gleamed, and it gleamed even stronger in Flutter's imagination. He took one look at Willikins' expression, and Mrs. Flutter's little boy decided he would sit very still until that nice Commander Vimes came back. Out of another pocket, Willikins produced the sharpest-looking knife Flutter had ever seen, and without paying any attention whatsoever to Flutter, began to clean his fingernails. In fact, it was only a matter of seconds before the trapdoor was heaved back, and Vimes emerged, then nodded to Willikins, who secured the comb and walked out of the room without a word. Vimes regained the chair. "Mr. Flutter, I have a witness statement that puts you on Hangman's Hill on the night in question with another man, said man being known as Stratford. The witness tells me that you said to him that you could have got hold of some turkey blood, but he said there were rabbits all over the place and he never missed with his slingshot. At this point, the witness says, a young goblin girl came out of the bushes, and your companion struck at her as she was begging for her life, and furiously, to the extent that you yourself told him, in your words, to leave off, upon which he turned on you, still holding his knife, described to me as a machete, so swiftly that you urinated into your boots." "No, don't speak, I haven't finished. Nevertheless, I'm informed that you did say to your companion that you were supposed to leave just blood and not, as you put it, guts all over the place, whereupon he forced you to put them back into the cadaver and hide it further down the hill in some gorse bushes." "No," I said, "don't talk. In your pocket you had a pork pie which you'd brought from home and $3 in cash, which was your payment for this little errand. After that, you and Stratford walked back some distance to your horses, which you had temporarily stabled in the tumble-down old barn on the other side of the village. The horses were a chestnut mare and a grey gelding, both of them broken down by ill use. In fact, the gelding threw a shoe as you were leaving, and you had to stop your companion from killing it there and then. Now, when a witness told me that you were naked to the waist when you left, since your shirt was soaked with blood, and you left it in the barn after an argument with Stratford. I'll recover it when we get back. Your friends told you to take your trousers off as well, but you declined. However, I noted splashes of blood on them earlier. I don't want to go to the expense of sending a rider back to the city, where my ego will ascertain whether the blood is human, goblin, or turkey. I said don't speak, didn't I? I haven't mentioned some of the other conversation between you and Mr. Stratford, because Feeney here is listening, and you should be relieved about that. Gossip can be so cruel. And now, Mr. Flutter, I'm going to stop talking, and upon doing so, I would like the first words you utter to be, 'Pay attention, I want to turn King's evidence.' Yes, I know we don't have kings anymore, but nobody has amended the law. You are a little shit, but I'm reluctantly persuaded that you were dragged into something beyond your control, and worse than you could have imagined. The good news is that Lord Vetinari will almost certainly take my advice, and you will live. Remember, I want to turn King's evidence. That's what I want to hear, Mr. Flutter. Otherwise, I'll go for a walk and Mr. Willikins will comb his hair." Flutter, who had listened to most of this with his eyes shut, blurted out the words so fast that Vimes had to ask him to repeat them more slowly. When he had finished, he was allowed to go to the privy, with Willikins waiting outside, cleaning his nails with his knife, and Feeney was sent to feed the frantic turkeys. For his part, Vimes entered one of the stinking sheds and prodded around in the dirty straw for what he knew would be there. He was not disappointed. Sufficiently close to, the smell of tobacco was just discernible above the stifling stink of turkey. he rolled a barrel out, found Feeney and said, "I think this is full of tobacco, and so I'm intending to take it as evidence. Your job right now is to scout out a jemmy for me, and somebody known to you as a decent, upstanding citizen, insofar as there might be one around this place." "Well, there's Dave who runs the Dog and Badger," Feeney volunteered. "And is he an upstanding citizen?" said Vimes. "I have seen him sitting down," said Feeney, "but he knows the score, if you get my meaning." Vimes nodded, and waited a few minutes before Feeney returned with a crowbar, a bandy-legged man, and a small tail of people who, for the moment, until proved otherwise, had to be counted as innocent bystanders. They gathered around as Vimes prepared to open the barrel. He announced, "Pay attention, gentlemen. I believe this barrel contains contraband goods." He rolled up his sleeves. "You see that I have nothing up my sleeves but a crowbar in my hand." And with some effort on his part, the lid of the barrel came off, and the smell of tobacco was overpowering, and some of the bystanders decided it was now time to take the wonderful opportunity for a quick, nonchalant walk. Vimes pulled out bale after bale of brown leaves bound with cotton. "Can't take too much on the coach," he said, "but if Mr. Dave here will, as an upstanding member of the community, sign to say that he saw me pull these from a sealed barrel, then you, Mr. Feeney, will take a brief statement, and we can all go about our business." Feeney beamed. "Oh, very well spotted, Commander. I reckon you could hide anything in this stink, eh?" After a moment, he looked at Vimes and said, "Commander?" Vimes appeared to look through him and said, "You're going to go far, Chief Constable Upshot. Let's empty the whole barrel, shall we?" He didn't know where the thought had come from. Maybe from first principles. If you were going to smuggle, where would you stop? What would your market be? How would you get the best price per pound of product carried? He pulled and pulled at the bundles, and one, almost at the bottom of the barrel, was noticeably heavier than the others. Trying to keep his expression unchanged, he handed the heavy bundle to Feeney and said, "I'd be grateful if you and Mr. Dave would open this bundle and tell me what you see inside." He sat down on the barrel and took a pinch of snuff, while behind him he heard the rustling, and then Feeney said, "Well, Commander, what this appears to be..." Vimes held up a hand. "Does it look like stone dust to you, Feeney?" "Yes, but..." Vimes held up his hand again. "Does it appear to have little red and blue flecks in it when you hold it up to the light?" Sometimes the ancestral copper in Feeney picked up the vibration. "Yes, Commander Vimes." "Then it's a good job for you and your friend Dave." Vimes glanced at said Dave for the second time and decided to give him the benefit of doubt. "That the two of you are not trolls, because if you were, you'd be stone dead, as it were, right now. The stuff you are holding is crystal slam, I'd bet my badge on it. Troll kids use it as a drug, you know that? They take a hit as small as your little pinky and think they can walk through walls, which they invariably do, too, and when they've done it a few times more, they drop down dead. It's illegal everywhere in the world, and very difficult to make because the smell when they're boiling it up is unmistakable. You get a lot of sparks, too. Selling it is a hanging offence in Ankh-Morpork, Uberwald, and every troll city. Diamond King of Trolls gives a very handsome bounty to anyone who presents him with evidence of manufacture." Vimes looked hopefully at the aforesaid Dave, just in case the man would take the bait. No, he thought, they wouldn't do it round here. All this tobacco must come from somewhere hot, and that means a long way away. Gingerly, they broke open other barrels and found plenty of tobacco, and several packs of very high-class cigars, one or two of which Vimes put in his breast pocket for detailed forensic examination later. And somewhere at the bottom of every barrel, there were neat packets of Crystal Slam, Slunky, Slab, Slice, and Slap, all of them very nasty, although Slap was generally considered to be a recreational drug, at least if your idea of recreation was waking up in the gutter not knowing whose head you had on. As many samples as possible were piled into the coach, and Vimes only stopped when it started to creak. The other barrels were piled up, and at Vimes's instigation, a very proud Chief Constable Upshot set fire to them. When the controlled drugs caught alight, there was a brief display of pyrotechnics, and Vimes thought to himself that this was only the start of the fireworks. As people came running out to see what was happening, Vimes reassured them of his bona fides and explained that Mr. Flutter would be away for a while, and could somebody please look after the birds. The responses he got made it clear that the neighbourhood considered a world without Mr. Flutter and his stinking turkeys would be a much better world, so the last thing that Vimes did was to open the sheds and let the wretched creatures take their chances. As a last little bright idea, Vimes beckoned to the nervous Dave and said, "Diamond King of Trolls will be very appreciative of this day's work. Of course, as serving officers, we wouldn't be able to take any remuneration." "We wouldn't," said Feeney, hopelessly. Vimes ignored this and continued, "I will, however, see to it that your help today is suitably rewarded." The publican's face lit up. Something about the words diamond and rewarded in the same sentence does that to a face. They travelled with the creaking coach doors locked, but with the window slightly open because Mr. Flutter was currently not somebody you would wish to be in any confined space with. He appeared to be sweating turkeys. King's evidence, that was a result. Flutter hadn't thought about arguing, and Vimes had seen his expression as the summoning Dark's statement was presented to him. Vimes had noticed every wince and shiver of recollection that, taken together, added up to rights well banged. King's evidence. Any man would opt for that to save his skin, or maybe for a better class of cell. You took King's evidence to save your miserable hide, and it might indeed do so, but at a price, and that price was death by hanging if you lied. It was one of the absolutes. Lying, when you had turned King's evidence, was a lie of lies. You had lied to the judge, you had lied to the king, you had lied to society, you had lied to the world, and thus the cheerful Mr. Trooper would welcome you to the gallows, and shake your hand to show you there were no hard feelings, and shortly afterwards would pull the lever that would drop you from the world you had betrayed and stop halfway down. And then, of course, there were the troll drugs. The evidence of their existence worried Flutter so much that he invented new gods to swear to that he knew nothing about them. Vimes believed him. As far as Flutter was concerned, the barrels contained nothing more than tobacco. Good old tobacco, nothing harmful about tobacco, and smuggling it was, well, it was really like a game, everybody knew that. Nothing wrong with that, smarting the revenue, that was what the revenue was for. Vimes thought, isn't that how I've always said it worked? Little crimes breeding big crimes. You smile at little crimes, and then big crimes blow your head off. Flutter was sitting miserably on the opposite seat, possibly fearing being kicked to death by trolls. But then, as Vimes had noted, Flutter probably feared everybody. And so Vimes found it in his heart to offer him not so much a crumb as a bacon sandwich of good news. You were in the company of a violent man, Ted. You thought you were just going to make life difficult for a copper, and suddenly you were an accessory of the first part to murder, and, even if unwittingly, tangled up in extremely serious troll narcotics, the worst there is. But you've got into bad company, Ted, and I will say so in court. Hope appeared in Flutter's red-rimmed eyes, and he said, "That's very kind of you, sir." That was it. No swagger, no whining, just gratitude for mercies received and fervently hoped for. Vimes leaned forward and offered the bewildered man his snuff-box. Flutter took a large pinch and sniffed it up so hard that the inevitable sneeze tried to escape via his ears. Ignoring this, and the faint haze of brown in the air, Vimes leaned back and said cheerfully, "I'll have a word with the screws and the tanty. They always owe me anyway." He looked at the hopeful face and thought, "Blast it. I know they're pretty crowded right now. A squirt like him would be on a hiding to nothing whatever I do." "Oh, well." He carried on. "No, Mr. Flutter. Tell you what I'll do. At least we'll put you in a cell in Pseudopolis Yard. How about that? It can be lonely in a cell all by yourself, but some might consider that a blessing. Especially after 15 minutes in some part of the tanty, and besides, my lads are fairly chatty when there's not much happening. We also have a better class of rat. The straw is fresh, and we don't gob in your stir about. And if you're helpful and don't keep people awake at night, then you'll be as right as rain." "You won't have any trouble from me, Commander." The words came tumbling, frantic to be heard and terrified they might not. "Glad to hear it, Ted," said Vimes jovially. "I like a man who makes the right choices. Incidentally, Ted, who suggested you play the little trick on the hill?" "Honestly, sir, it was Stratford, sir. He said it would be a little joke. And I know what you're going to ask me next, sir, and I asked him who was behind all this, because it worried me a bit, seeing as mostly I breastfeed turkeys and roll barrels around, you understand?" Flutter assumed the expression of a simple, honest working man. "He said that if he told me, he'd have to kill me, and I said to him, I said, 'Thank you all the same, Mr. Stratford, but I won't put you to the trouble.' And I kept my mouth shut because he had a funny look in his eye." Flutter seemed to think for a moment and added, "He always has a funny look in his eye." Vimes tried to pretend that this was of little interest. Like a man with a butterfly net, a killing jar, and a passion to pin to a corkboard the last of the very rare Lanka blue butterflies that has just taken its repose on a thistle nearby, he tried to do nothing to make his quarry take flight. In an offhand way, he said, "But you do know, don't you, Ted? I mean, you're smart, Ted, underneath it all. A lot of people would say that two planks were smarter than you, but frankly, you can't make a success of things in this old world without keeping your eyes open and your ears too, right? But of course, who would tell anything important to a twerp like Flutter? He wasn't even a henchman. You needed a certain amount of tactical thinking before you could properly hench. But henchmen hang about, and when they're with somebody as thick as Flutter, they don't always guard their tongues. Aloud, he said, "It's a shame, really, Ted, you being the only one to get banged up for all this. Seeing that all you really did was help out a mate for a couple of dollars and a pint, don't you think? Terrible, isn't it? A decent folk have to take the rap, yes? Especially when it's a big rap." He stopped talking and watched Flutter's face. "Well," said Flutter, "one day, when he was a bit excited, he did say to me that Lord Rust depended on him, took him into his confidence and everything, and made sure his pockets always jingled, but I reckon that was nothing but boasting." Vimes was impressed at his own patience, and said, "Look, Ted, did you ever hear either of them talk about the Goblin Girl?" A horrible grin suffused the man's face. "I could if you want me to, Commander." Vimes stared at Flutter for a moment and said, "Ted, I want to know things that you have either seen or heard, not things you may have imagined, and this is the important bit, Ted, not things made up to please me, right? Otherwise I won't any longer be your friend." Vimes stopped to think for a moment. "Did you ever hear Lord Rust or Stratford say anything about the blacksmith?" It was an education watching the prisoner rack his brains. He looked like a big dog chewing a toffee. Apparently he found something, because his next words were, "The blacksmith? I didn't know that it was about the blacksmith. Yeah, when we were stacking in the yard, young Lord Rust came out to Stratford and said something like, 'Any news about our friend?' And, well, Stratford said, 'Don't you worry, sir, he's going to see the Queen.' And they both laughed, sir." In the silence he said, "Are you all right, sir?" Vimes ignored this and said, "Have you any idea what he meant?" "No, sir," said Flutter. "Is there anything called the Queen around here? Maybe a public house, perhaps? Maybe a riverboat?" Vimes thought, "Yes, they all have strange names. There has to be a queen among them." Once again the dog chewed the toffee. "Sorry, Commander, I don't really know anything about that. No boat on the river called the Queen." Vimes left it at that. It was a result. Not the best result, nothing that would satisfy Vetinari, but a hint at least of a minor conspiracy to send Jethro to somewhere he did not want to be. Vimes at least had to be satisfied. Vimes realised that Flutter was holding up his hand cautiously, like a child half fearful of a reprimand from the teacher. "Yes, Ted," he said wearily. The man lowered his hand. "Will I be able to find a god, sir?" "What? Find what god?" Flutter looked embarrassed but recovered manfully. "Well, sir, I'm hearing about people who go into prison and find a god, sir. And if you find a god, then you get better treatment, and maybe you get let out sooner on account of praying. And I was wondering, if I was in the watch house, whether there might be more or less chance of god availability, if you get my drift. I don't want to be a trouble, of course." "Well, Ted, if there was any justice in the universe, I think there'd be quite a few gods in the Tanti. But if I were you and faced a choice between the possibility of heavenly intervention and a definite 3 meals a day that haven't been spat on and no big bloke snoring in your ear all night, and the certain knowledge that if you have to go down on your knees it will only be to pray, then I would say heaven can wait." The sun was already well up now, and Willikins was keeping them moving at a good pace. Vimes took notice of that fact. The street was talking to him, even if it was in fact nothing more than a wide lane. He nudged Feeney awake. "Soon be home now, lad, and I think Mr. Flutter can be housed in your lovely lock-up, don't you?" Flutter looked puzzled, and Vimes said, "Good grief, man, surely you didn't think I could rush you all the way to Ankh-Morpork in one go. As it is, I'll have to send someone to get someone else to come all the way down here with the hurry-up wagon. Don't worry, the lock-up is strong and cosy and made of stone plus, and I'm led to believe that this is indeed a big plus, this. Mrs. Upshot will probably make you a delicious bang-suck-muck-muck dog with carrots and garden peas, speciality de maisonette." Rank has its privileges, Vimes thought, when he alighted near the old lock-up a little later. "Chief Constable Upshot, please settle our prisoner down, see that he gets fed and watered and so on and so forth, okay, and obviously do the paperwork."
"Do what, sir?"
Vimes blinked. "Is it possible, Mr. Feeney, that you don't know what paperwork is?" Feeney was perplexed. Well, yes, sir, of course, but generally I just jot down the name in my notebook, sir. I mean, I know who he is, and I know where he is, and I know what he's done. Oh, yes, and since the trouble we had with old Mr. Parsley, after he had a skinful, I also make certain to check if the prisoner is allergic to anything in the Bang Bang Duck cuisine. It took me all day to clean out the place, on account of there had been a tiny bit of winky. Seeing Vimes's expression, he went on, "Very popular herb, sir." "Habeas corpus, lad. You want to be the copper here, right? Then Mr. Flutter is your prisoner. You're responsible for him. If he gets ill, then he is your problem. If he dies, then he is your corpse. And if he gets out and away, then you would find yourself in a situation so problematical that the word problem just would not fit the situation. I'm trying to be helpful, honestly, but I could just as easily take him up to the hall. We got loads of cellars, and we could easily bed him down in one of them, no problem. But then if I have to do that, what good are you?" Feeney looked shocked. He pulled himself upright. "I wouldn't hear of that, sir, and neither would my ancestors, sir. After all, we've never had anyone who has even been near a murder." "Very well, then. Give me a receipt for the prisoner, which is a very important thing, and I'll go back to the hall and have a nap." Vimes stepped back as a riverboat came into view, and a very small tidal wave of muddy water splashed gently on the little quayside. The boat was another one with paddle wheels. Sybil had explained all about them. An ox patiently trod its way around a treadmill in the bilges, and wonderful gearing caused the paddle wheels to turn. The pilot of this one waved at him. As it went past, he saw a woman in the stern hanging out clothing, watched by a cat. "A good life, at the speed of an ox," he thought, "where probably no one is ever going to try to kill you." And just for a moment he felt jealous, while a line of barges followed the boat past a flotilla of ducklings. Vimes sighed, got back in the coach, was driven to the hall by Willikins, and after a very brief shower, sank into the pillows and descended into darkness. People said that these days Ankh-Morpork was moving. Others said that while this might be true, so was a sufficiently aged cheese. And like the hypothetical cheese, it was bursting out of its mould, in this case the outermost walls, which were, in the words of Lord Veterinari, a corset that should be unlaced. One of the first to let themselves spread had been Harry King, now of course known as Sir Harold King. He was a scallywag, a chancer, a ruthless fighter and a dangerous driver of bargains over the speed limit. Since all this was a bit of a mouthful, he was referred to as a successful businessman, since that more or less amounted to the same thing. And he had a knack of turning rubbish into money. As Captains Carrot and Angua walked along the towpath towards the reedy swamps downriver, Harry King's flame burned ahead of them. All was grist to the mills of the King of Muck. His armies of workers swept the streets, emptied the cesspits, cleaned the chimneys, scoured the middens of the slaughterhouse district, and carried away from those self-same houses all those bits of previously living matter that could not, for the love of decency, be put in a sausage. They said that Harry King would suck the smoke out of the air if he thought they would get a good price for it. And if you wanted a job, Harry King would give you one, at a wage not very much less than you might get elsewhere in the city, and if you stole from Harry King, you would get what you deserved. The mills of Harry King stank, of course, but now the city itself did not, at least not as badly as it used to. And some people were complaining about the loss of the famous Ankh-Morpork smell, rumoured to be so strong that it kept away illnesses and ailments of all sorts, and, moreover, put hairs on your chest and did you good. Ankh-Morpork being what it was, there was already a smell preservation society. The two watchmen began to breathe less deeply as they approached the smoke and fumes. A small city surrounded the workings, a shanty town knocked together with Harry's blessing by the workers themselves because, after all, that meant they wouldn't be late for work. A security officer at the gate opened it instantly as they approached. Harry was probably not honest, but if there was dishonesty, it happened at times and places that did not concern the watch, and faded from the memory of all concerned just as soon as the ripples of the splash had died away and the tide had gone out. Also going out, as Carrot and Angua climbed the outside steps to the large office where Harry presided over his kingdom, was a man moving horizontally at speed, with Harry King's big hands grasping him by his collar and the seat of his pants, and finally throwing him down the steps, accompanied by a shout, "You're fired!" The watchman stood aside as the man rolled down from step to step. "And if I see you again, the dogs is always hungry. Oh, hello, Captain Carrot," said Harry, his voice suddenly all matey. "And the charming Miss Angua, too. My word, what a lovely surprise. Do come in. Always a pleasure to be of assistance to the watch." "Sir Harry, you really shouldn't throw people down the steps like that," said Carrot. Harry King looked innocent and spread his huge hands widely, and said, "What? Are those bloody steps still there? I gave orders to have them taken away. Thank you for the advice, Captain, but the way I see it is that I caught him trying to steal my money, and so if he's still alive, then on the whole, I reckon we're square. Coffee? Tea? Something stronger?" "Nah, thought not. But take a seat, no harm in that, at least." They sat down, and Carrot said, "We need to talk about goblins." Harry King looked blank, but said, "Got a few of them working for me, if that's any help. Decent workers, you might be surprised to know. A bit weird in their ways, not the fastest, but once they got the hang of what you want them to do, you can just leave them to it until you tell them to stop. I pay them half what I pay humans, and I reckon they do twice as much work, and do it better. Be happy to hire another 100 if they turned up."
"But you pay them far less than humans," said Angua. Harry gave her a pitying look.
"And who else would pay them anything at all, love, eh? Well, business is business. It's not like I chain them down." "Okay, not many people would want to employ goblins on account of the stink, but I know by the wrinkling in your pretty nose, Captain, that I stink too. Goes with a job. Besides, I let them stay on my land, and they make those weird little pots in their spare time, and I see to it they don't have much of that, and when they have enough money for whatever they want, they bugger off back to where they came from. Young Slick and his granny are the only ones that's ever stayed. Going to make a name for himself, that one." "We'd like to talk to some of the goblins about the pots you mentioned, if that's okay by you, Harry," said Carrot. Harry King smiled and waggled a finger at him. "Now, I'll take that from you two, because we've all seen a bit of the world and know what's what. But outside this office, it's Sir Harry, okay? Personally, I ain't all that bothered, but her ladyship is a stickler. Oh, my word, yes. No, so I near. It brings down sparrows, I'm telling you. Still, I can't say it does any harm." Harry King, or possibly Sir Harold King, thought for a moment. "Out of interest, why do you want to talk about goblin pots?" Angua hesitated, but Carrot said, "We are both very interested in goblin folklore, Sir Harry." Harry King chuckled. "You know, I never could read your face, Captain Carrot. I'd hate to play poker with you." "Okay, it's not my business. I'll take you at your word. Just you go down the steps, make your way to the sorting belts, and find Billy Slick, and tell him that Harry King would deem it a favour if he would be so good as to take you to see his old granny, okay? No need to thank me. I suspect old Vimes put in a good word about me to Veterinary when the medals have been given out, if you know what I mean. They say one hand washes the other, but I bet that when it come to old Harry King it adds a scrub." They found Billy Slick stacking old copies of the Ankh-Morpork Times onto a truck. You could always recognise a goblin, although this one, in his grubby overall, looked like any other working man in the place. The only difference was that he was a goblin working man. Carrot tapped him gently on the shoulder, and Billy looked round.
"Oh, coppers.
We've come from Harry King, Billy," said Carrot, adding quickly, "You've done nothing wrong. We just want to learn about ungue pots."
"You want to learn about ungue?" Billy stared at Carrot. "I know I ain't done nothing wrong, Gov, and I don't need you to do the telling of me, and I wouldn't touch any of those bloody pots to save my life. I'm working my way up, I am. Can't be bothered with fairy stories."
Angua stepped forward and said, "Mr. Slick, this is quite important. We need to find someone who can tell us about ungue pots. Do you know anyone who can help?" Billy looked her up and down superciliously.
"You're a werewolf, ain't you? I can smell you a mile off. And what would you do if I said I didn't know anybody?"
"Then," said Carrot, "we would regrettably have to go about our business." Billy looked sideways at him.
"Would that be the business of giving me a good kicking?"
The morning sun shone on Carrot's enthusiastically polished breastplate. "No, Mr. Slick, it would not." Billy looked him up and down.
"Well, there's my granny. Maybe she'll talk to you, maybe she won't. I'm only telling you that much because of Mr. King. She's right careful about who she talks to, but you may bet your helmet on that. What do you want to talk about pots for, anyway? She hardly gets out of bed these days. Can't see her doing a robbery."
"Nor do we, Billy. We just want some information about the pots."
"Well, you've come to the right lady. She's an expert, so I reckon. Always fussing about the bloody things. Got a bottle of brandy on you. She's not one for strangers, my granny, but I reckon that anyone with a bottle of brandy is no stranger to granny, as long as the drink holds out."
Angua whispered to Carrot, "Harry's got a huge drinks cabinet in his office, and it's not like this is bribery. Worth a try?" She waited with Billy Slick while Carrot went on the errand, and for something to say, she said, "Billy Slick doesn't sound much like a goblin name." Billy made a face.
"Too right. Granny calls me Of the Wind Regretfully Blown. What kind of name is that, I ask you? Who's going to take you seriously with a name like that? This is modern times, right?"
He looked at her defiantly, and she thought, "And so, one at a time, we all become human. human werewolves, human dwarfs, human trolls. The melting pot melts in one direction only, and so we make progress. Aloud, she said, "Aren't you proud of your goblin name?" He looked at her with his mouth open, showing his pointy teeth. "What? Proud? Why the frickle should anybody be proud of being a goblin? Except me granny, of course. Come along inside, and I surely hope that the brandy arrives quickly. She can be fretful without the brandy." Billy Slick and his granny lived in a building of sorts in the shantytown. Willow and other saplings had been liberated from the damp swamps and used to make a reasonably large hemisphere, the size of a small cottage. It seemed to Angua that some skill and thought had gone into the construction. Smaller twigs and branches had been interwoven with the structure, and some had, as is the way with Willow, rooted themselves and sprouted. And then somebody, presumably Billy Slick, had further interwoven the new growth, so that, in the summertime at least, it was a pretty good gaff, especially since somebody had meticulously filled most of the gaps with smaller weaves. Inside, it was a smoky cave, but the dark, accustomed eye of the werewolf saw that the inner walls had been lined very carefully with old tarpaulin and any other rubbish that could be persuaded to bend to keep away draughts. Okay, it had probably taken less than 2 days to build and cost nothing, but the city was full of people who would have been overjoyed to live there. "Sorry about this," said Billy. "I can't say that Harry is a big payer, but he turns a blind eye to us snaffling the occasional bits and pieces if we don't get cheeky about it." "But you've even got a stovepipe," said Angua, astonished. Billy looked down. "Leaks a bit. Waiting for me to solder a few patches on, that's all. Wait here, I'll just make sure she's ready for you. I know she'll be ready for the brandy." There was a polite knock on the door, which turned out to be courtesy of Captain Carrot, who was on his way back with the brandy. He carefully opened the battered and many times painted outside door and let in some light. Then he looked around and said, "Very cozy." Angua tapped her foot. "Look, he's even jigsawed broken bits of roof tile together to make a decent floor cover. There's some thoughtful construction going on here." She lowered her voice and whispered, "And he's a goblin. It's not what I'd expected."
"Got bloody good hearing as well, miss," said Billy, re-entering the room. "Amazing, innit, what tricks us goblins can learn? Caw, you'd almost think we were people."
He pointed towards a hanging of some sort of felt that obscured the other end of the room.
"Got the brandy wine? Off we go, then. Hold the bottle out in front of you, that usually does the trick. Officers, the lady ain't my granny as such, she's my great-granny, but that was too much of a mouthful for me when I was a little kid, so granny she became. Let me do the talking, 'cause unless you are a bloody genius, you won't understand a blind word she says. Come on in, quickly. I've got to go and make her lunch in half an hour, and like I said, you've probably got until the drink runs out." "I can't see a thing," said Carrot, as the felt somberly swung back behind them, and Angua said carefully, "I can. Would you be so good as to introduce us to your great-grandmother, Billy?" Carrot still fought for any kind of vision, but heard what he thought was the goblin boy speaking, although it sounded as if he was chewing gravel at the same time. Then, after a sense of movement in the darkness, another voice, crackling like ice, answered him. Then Billy quite clearly said, "Regret of the Falling Leaf welcomes you, watchman, and bids you give her the bloody brandy right now." Carrot held the bottle out in the direction of Billy's voice, and it was swiftly passed on to the shape beginning to form in front of him as sight trickled back. The shape apparently said, according to Billy, "Why do you come to me, policeman? Why do you need help from dying lady? What is Ungu to you, Mr. Policeman? Ungu is ours, ours, no good for you here, big Mr. Policeman." "What is Ungu, madam?" said Carrot. "No religion, no ringing bellsy, no knees all bendy, no chorus, no hallelujah, no by your leave, just Ungu, pure Ungu. Just Ungu, who come when need, little Ungu, when gods wash hands and turn away, there is Ungu, who roll up the sleeves. Ungu strikes in the dark. If Ungu doesn't come himself, he send. Ungu is everywhere." Carrot cleared his throat. "Regret of the Falling Leaf, we have a man, a policeman, a good man, who is dying of Ungu. We don't understand. Please help us understand. In his hand, he is holding an Ungu pot." The screech must have echoed around the works. It certainly made the little shack rock. "Ungu thief, pot stealer, not fit to live," Billy translated with every sign of embarrassment. The old goblin woman tried to stand up and sank back into her cushions, muttering. Angua tried, "You are wrong, old lady. This pot came to him by chance. He found it. It is the pot called Soul of Tears." Regret of the Falling Leaf had filled the world with noise. Now she appeared to empty it with silence.
She said, bitterly, and come to that curiously, considering the fact that her great-grandson had said she didn't know much Ankh-Morpokian, "Found in Goblin Cave, oh yes. Found on end of shovel, oh yes. Bad cess to him." "No." Suddenly Carrot was face to face with the Goblin Woman. "It came to him by accident, like a curse. He never wanted it, and he didn't know what it was. He found it in a cigar." There was a pause in which, presumably, the old woman was doing some complex thinking, because she said, "Would you pay me my price, Mr. Policeman?" "We gave you the brandy," said Angua.
"Indeedy, Wolf Whelp, but that was for consultation only. Now it's price for diagnosis and cure, which will be from the snuff mill, 2 pounds of sweet raspberry, 1 pound of Angler's Chum, and 1 pound of Dr. Vary's medicated upright mixture. Just the job on a winter's day."
Something like a laugh escaped from the old goblin woman's mouth.
"Glad of the fresh air," she added. "My lad, he gets around and about and says you are trustworthy, but goblins have learned not to rely on words, so we will seal the bargain the old way, which we have all understood since time was time."
The bewildered Billy stood back as a long hand with longer fingernails extended towards Carrot, who spat on his own hand and slapped it, with no thought of health and safety, onto the palm of Regret of the Fallen Leaf, who cackled again.
"That can't be broke, that, it can't be broke, never."
After a moment's hesitation, she said, in an offhand voice, "Wash hand after using." There was a glug from the brandy bottle, and Billy Slick's old granny went on.
"A pot of tears, you say?"
Angua nodded.
"If so, only one meaning. A poor goblin woman, a starving woman, had to eat her newborn baby because she could not feed it. I hear you stop breathing for a moment. That such things happen is awful truth, oh yes. Is often awful truth in bad country when times are hard and food is nothing. And so, weeping, she carved a little ungue pot for soul of her baby, and cried life into it, and sent it away until better times when baby will come back."
Quietly, Carrot said, "Could you tell us anything more, madam?" The old goblin was silent for a moment and then said,
"Inside cigar wrapped in tobacco. Ask a man who sell tobacco."
Billy turned his granny's brandy bottle upside down, and not a drop came out.
"One last thing, please, madam. How can we help our friend? By the sound of it, he's dreaming that he's a goblin."
Little black eyes shone as the goblin said,
"I trusting you for tobacco. Now trusting you for another bottle of brandy. Find Goblin Cave, find Goblin Maiden. Only such a one will be able to grasp the pot in hope one day of having child. So it goes. No other way. And big problem for you, Mr. Policeman, is that goblin girl these days are hard to find. None here. Maybe none anywhere. We shrivel and shrink like old leaves. Goodbye until more brandy. No, make that cognac from Quirm, special reserve, $60 if bought from Horrid's on Broadway, or 2-for-1 deal at Twister Boots Bottle Shop in the Shades. Slight taste of anchovy, but no questions asked and unanswered."
The old voice went silent, and gently the watchman came back to the stuff of reality around them, troubling images fading into recent memory. Carrot managed to say, "I'm so sorry to have to ask, but will this harm my sergeant? He seems to be having continuous nightmares, and we can't get the pot out of his hand."
"Three bottle of brandy, Mr. Policeman,"
translated Billy. Carrot nodded.
"Okay. How long pot had him?"
Carrot looked angry.
"About 2 days, madam." "Then get your man to a goblin cave as quick as you can, Mr. Policeman. He may live, he may die. Either way, 3 bottle of brandy, Mr. Policeman."
Small black eyes twinkled at Carrot.
"So nice to meet a real gentleman. Hurry up, Mr. Policeman."
The old lady slumped back into her mound of pillows and rugs. The audience was over, just like the brandy.
"Granny likes you," said Billy, his voice full of awe as he ushered them out.
"I can tell. She never threw anything at you. Better get her the snuff and the brandy pretty soon, however, otherwise she might get a bit stroppy in an occult sort of way, if you hear what I'm saying. Or rather, of course, what I ain't saying. Nice to meet you, folks, but old man King doesn't like to see people not working."
"Excuse me, Billy," said Carrot, grabbing him by his skinny arm.
"Are there any goblin caves anywhere around here?"
"You got what you wanted, officer. There ain't none as far as I know. I don't care. You could try up country, that's my advice, but I really don't care. If you find a goblin cave on a map, you can bet your teeth there won't be any goblins there any more, not live ones at least.
Thank you very much for your assistance, Mr. Slick, and may I congratulate you on having a grandmother with such a good grasp of contemporary vocabulary, said Carrot.
There was a delightful shriek from the direction of the dome, the walls of which were very thin.
Damn right! Granny Slick ain't so thick!
Well, perhaps we have a result, said Carrot as they headed back into the city. But, well, I know Ankh-Morpork is a melting pot of a city, but don't you think it's rather sad when people come here and forget their ancestry?
Yes, said Angua, not looking at him. It is.
When they were back in Pseudopolis Yard, Carrot summoned Cheery.
I'd like you to go and see the tobacconist. Ask him where this tobacco comes from. We know there's lots of smuggling going on anyway, so he'll be worried. It might be a nice idea to take along an officer whose mere presence will worry him a little more. Wee Mad Arthur is back from leave.
Cheery grinned.
In that case, I'll take him. He worries everybody.
Mr. Bewilderforce Gumption was having a good day so far. He had been to the bank to deposit the takings and had bought two tickets to the opera. Mrs. Gumption would be very pleased about that, and certainly more pleased than she was to be called a Gumption. She was always urging him into high society, or at least higher society, but in some ways the name Gumption always held you back. And now he held open the door to his emporium and saw the policeman sitting patiently in the chair.
Cheery Littlebottom stood up. Mr. Bewilderforce Gumption, he tried to smile.
I generally see Fred Coulon, officer.
Yes, and it's Sergeant Littlebottom. But strangely enough, it's about Sergeant Coulon that I'm visiting you today. Do you remember giving him a cigar?
Mr. Gumption was suffering from the illusion that many people have, that policemen don't see people lying all the time, so he said, not as I recall, to which Cherry replied,
Mr. Gumption, it is a well-known fact that Sergeant Coulon buys or otherwise procures his tobacco requirements from your noble establishment.
Once again, Bewilderforce led off on the wrong note. I want to see my lawyer.
I'd like to see your lawyer as well, Mr. Gumption. Perhaps you'd send someone to collect him while I and my colleague wait here.
Bewilderforce looked around, bewildered.
What colleague?
Oh, aye, that'll be me well enough,
said the constable known sometimes briefly as Wee Mad Arthur, who had been lurking behind a packet of cigarettes.
Two police officers are far more than doubly worse than one, and Cheery Littlebottom took advantage of the sudden panic to say, carefully,
It's a very simple question, Mr. Gumption. Where did that cigar come from?
Cheery was aware that Commander Vimes didn't like the phrase, the innocent have nothing to fear, believing the innocent had everything to fear, mostly from the guilty, but in the longer term, even more from those who say things like, the innocent have nothing to fear. But Bewilderforce was fearful. She could see him sweating.
We know you're a smuggler, Mr. Gumption, or perhaps I should say that you take advantage of very good deals when they are, ahem, presented to you. Right now, however, all I need from you is to tell me where that cigar came from. Once you've been so kind as to tell me that, we'll walk out of this building in a happy and cooperative frame of mind.
Bewilderforce brightened up. Cheery continued,
Of course, other departments of the watch might wish to visit you in due course. At the moment, sir, you just have to deal with me. Do you know where that batch of cigars came from?
Valiantly, Bewilderforce tried it on.
I buy from dealers all the time, he said. It'll take me ages to go through the records.
Cheery kept smiling.
No problem there, Mr. Gumption. I'll call for my expert colleague, Mr. A.E. Pessimal, right now. I don't know if you know of him. It's amazing how quickly he can work through paperwork, and I'm sure he'll find time in his busy schedule to help you out at no cost whatsoever.
5 minutes later, a grey-faced and breathless Bewilderforce handed Cheery a small scrap of paper. Cheery looked up at him.
For Wonderland, I thought that tobacco mostly came from Clatch.
Bewilderforce shrugged.
Well, they've been starting up plantations in Hawunderland now. Good stuff, too.
Feeling a little bit bolder, Bewilderforce went on.
All properly paid for, I can tell you. Yes, I know there's smuggling going on, but we don't have any truck with that. No need to when you can get a pretty good deal by buying in bulk. It's all in my ledgers, every invoice, every payment, all set down properly.
Cheery relented. A.E. Pessimal could probably find something to excite him somewhere in the Gumption ledgers. After all, business was business. But there was business, and there was bad business. It didn't do to get complicated. She stood up.
Thank you very much for your assistance, Mr. Gumption. We'll trouble you no further.
Bewilderforce hesitated and said, What's up with Fred Coulon? He's a bit of a scrounger, I don't mind saying, but I would hate anything to have happened to him. It wasn't poison or anything, was it?
"No, Mr. Gumption. His cigar started singing to him."
"They don't usually do that," said Bewilderforce nervously. "I'll have to check my stock."
"Please do that, sir, and while you're doing so, perhaps you'll look out this little list of snuff products."
The tobacconist took it from her carefully. His lips moved, and he said, "That's quite a lot of snuff, you know."
"Yes, sir," said Cherry. "I'm authorised to pay cash down."
Bewilderforce looked extremely bewildered. "What? Policeman pay?" Walking the streets in the company of Wee Mad Arthur presented a difficulty even for a dwarf like Cheery Littlebottom. He was around 6 inches high, so if you spoke to him while you walked, you sounded like a madman. On the other hand, he heartily disliked being picked up, so you just had to put up with it. Most people made a slight detour if they saw Wee Mad Arthur in any case. They arrived back at the watch house and reported to Carrot, and the first thing he said to Cheery was, "Do you know where there are any goblin caves, Cheery?"
"No, sir, why do you ask?"
"I'll explain later," said Carrot. "It's fairly unbelievable. Did you find out anything from old Gumption?"
Cheery nodded. "Yes, sir. Sergeant Colon's haunted cigar came from Hoonderland, no doubt about it."
Carrot stared at her. "I didn't think there were any goblins in Hoonderland. All Jolson's family come from there." He snapped his fingers. "Hang on one moment." He ran down the corridor to the canteen and came back followed by Constable Precious Jolson, a lady for whom the word large simply would not do. Everything about her was, as it were, family-sized, including her good nature. Everybody liked Precious. She seemed to be a fountainhead of jolliness, with always a cheerful word for anybody, even when she was picking up a brace of drunks and throwing them into the hurry-up wagon. After brief questioning, Precious said, "Dad sent me over there last year, remember, wanted me to find my roots. Can't say I took to it, really. Nice weather, not much to do. Not very exciting, really, unless you try to stroke one of the cats, they get kind of stroppy. Never heard of goblins there, not the sort of place for them, I suspect. Excuse me, Captain, can I get back to me tea now?" The silence that followed was broken by Carrot, who said, "Hoonderland is months away by boat, and broomsticks don't work very well over water, even if we could persuade the wizards to lend us one. Any ideas?"
"Crivens," said Wee Man Arthur. "No problemo. I reckon I could get there in less than a day, you ken."
They stared at him. Wee Mad Arthur was small enough to ride on the back of any bird larger than a medium-sized hawk. His aerial broadcasts from the sky concerning traffic hold-ups in the city, which were in fact a permanency in any case, were a regular feature of Ankh-Morpork street life. But all the way to another continent? He grinned.
"As you ken, I was away for a wee while lately, making the acquaintance of my brothers, the Nac Mac Feagle. Well, they fly the birds a lot, and there's a thing they have called the crow step, you ken, and I reckon I'm canny enough to use it, you ken."
"That's three kens in one speech, Wee Mad Arthur," said Angua, to laughter from the rest of the watchmen. "You really got into the Feagle thing, didn't you?"
"Oh, you may scoff, but I'm the only one of your scunners who knows why we get so many big buds flying over the city at this time of year. Ankh-Morpork is hot. See the big plume of smoke and fumes? That's all heat. It lifts ye up. A free ride that puts the wind under your wings. Have you heard of the surreptitious albatross?"
"No, because only me and the Professor of Ornithology at the University know about it, and he only knows because I told the scunner. Outside the mating season, it never touches ground. That's not the only thing that's odd. It's an eagle masquerading as a type of albatross. You could call it a shark of the sky, and I reckon one of them will do me nicely. They like the city. They hover up where you'll never see them unless you really know how to look. There's always one about, and I could leave today, what you say?"
"But, Constable," said Carrot, "you'll freeze that high up in the sky, won't you?"
"Oh, aye, a Ken Mathelma draws may not be sufficient, which is why the word brandy is about to enter this conversation. Trust me on this, Captain, I reckon I'm coming back within 2 days.
"How many is that?" said Angua. Wee Mad Arthur rolled his eyes.
2, Captain, for the likes of you."
In fact, it took Wee Mad Arthur only an hour to identify the peaceful-looking bird drifting happily high above the city with the meal it had just had, courtesy of a seagull, the feathers of which were even now drifting gently towards the cityscape below. The surreptitious albatross had no enemies that it couldn't easily digest, and paid little attention to the nondescript and relatively harmless hawk soaring towards it, right up until it found Wee Mad Arthur landing on its back. It struggled, but was unable to reach the Feagle because he was sitting comfortably and had his hands around its neck. Wee Mad Arthur tended towards the swift methods of domesticating wildlife. The surreptitious albatross fought for yet more height by constantly spiralling up on the huge wide pillar of free lift, as Ankh-Morpork was known and understood by the avian community, and Wee Mad Arthur passed the time by memorising a tiny pencilled map of the world. Really, it wasn't difficult. On the whole, continents aren't hard to find, and neither are the edges of continents, where, by general consensus, you tended to find ships moored. Wee Mad Arthur was the world expert at looking for things from above, which amused him, given that most people who wanted to see Wee Mad Arthur had to look down. Oh, well, he thought, let's go. It was called the Craw Step, and the Nacmac Fegal of the Chalk Country had carefully shown their brother how it works when you are sitting on top of a large bird. People in Ankh-Morpork looked up at the bang high above, and then, given that the sky was still clear, lost interest. Meanwhile, on one astonished, surreptitious albatross sat one hugely satisfied Fegal, who settled down in the feathers and began to eat a piece of the single hard-boiled egg and 2-inch slice of bread that were his rations for the trip. Wee Mad Arthur was, as a Fegal, a very economical watchman to have, given that, size for size, he ate in a year what human watchmen ate in a week, although it had to be admitted that he could drink, size for size, more alcohol in a week than any human watchman could drink in a year. While the universe rushed past them, making a noise like, "Wee!" Darkness had lasted about 4 hours when Vimes was woken up by a small boy bouncing up and down on the bed, and therefore on Sam Vimes, and saying, "Winnikins has found a bird that just died, Dad. Mum says I can dissect it if you say it's all right, Dad." Vimes managed to mumble, "Yeah, all right, if your mother says so," before slipping back into the black. And the black spread around him. He heard himself thinking, "The summoning dark could tell me everything I need to know, and that is the truth. But would the truth that it told me be the truth? And how would I know that? If I rely on it, then in some way I become its creature. Or perhaps it becomes mine. Perhaps we have an accord, and it helped me under Coombe Valley, and because of that the world is a better place. Surely the darkness has no reason to lie. I've always liked the night, the dead of night, those nights that are sheer blackness, making dogs nervous and causing sheep to leap their hurdles out of terror. Darkness has always been my friend, but I cannot let it be my master, though sooner or later I will have to take an oath, and if I lie, me, the chief policeman, then what am I? How could I ever again rebuke a copper for looking the other way?" He turned over among the pillows. "And yet the cause is good. It is a good cause. The man Stratford did kill the goblin girl. I have the evidence of his associate, and the word of a being whose assistance has been of material use to society. Admittedly, I have put a man in fear, but then people like Flutter are always in fear, and better that he fears me than Stratford, because I at least know when to stop. He's just another red ball on the bays, and for that matter, I suppose, so is Stratford. He'll have a boss. They always have a knobby boss, because nearly everybody around here is either a worker or knobby, and as far as I know, practically everybody doesn't have a good word to say for goblins. It's a target-rich environment, and the trouble with a target-rich environment is that it is useless if you don't know which target you have to aim at." Vimes dropped back into deep sleep, and was almost instantly shaken awake by the best efforts of his son, industriously pounding on the heap that was Vimes in slumber. "Mum says to come, Dad. She says there's a man." Vimes wasn't a dressing-gown type of person, so he struggled back into his clothing and made himself as presentable as a man could, who needed a shave and didn't appear to have the time to get one. There was a man sitting in the lounge wearing a fantailer hat, jodhpurs, and a nervous smile. Three things that mildly annoyed Vimes. A nervous smile generally meant that somebody was after something they shouldn't have. He personally thought a fantailer looked silly, and as for the jodhpurs, no man should meet a copper if he is wearing trousers that make his legs look as though he has just burgled a house full of silverware and shoved it hastily down his trousers. In fact, Vimes thought he could see the outline of a teapot, but possibly that was his eyes playing mischievous tricks on him. The wearer of this presumably self-inflicted triple misfortune stood up as Vimes entered. "Your Grace." "Sometimes," said Vimes, "what can I do for you?" The man looked apprehensively at Lady Sybil, who was sitting comfortably in the corner with a little smile on her face, and said, "Your Grace, I am afraid I must serve you with this cease and desist order on behalf of the Board of Magistrates for this county. I am very sorry about this, Your Grace, and I hope you will understand that it does go against the grain to have to do this to a gentleman. But no one is above the law, and the law must be obeyed.
I myself am William Stoner, clerk to said justices." Mr. Stoner hesitated because Vimes had strolled over to the door. "Just making sure you don't leave in a hurry," said Vimes, as he locked the door. "Do sit down, Mr. Stoner, because you're just the man I want to talk to." The clerk sat down carefully, clearly not wanting to be that man. He held in front of him a scroll with a red wax seal affixed, the kind of thing believed to make a document official, or at least expensive and difficult to understand, which, in fact, amounts to the same thing. Suddenly, Vimes realised that all those years being confronted by Lord Vetinari had in fact been a masterclass, had he but known. Well, it was time for the examination. He went back to his chair, sat back comfortably, steepled his fingers together, and frowned at the clerk over the top of them for 10 whole seconds, a length of time that used to unnerve him every time it happened, and so should surely work on this little tit. Then he cracked the silence with, "Mr. Stoner, 3 nights ago, murder was committed on my land. Land ownership means something around here, doesn't it, Mr. Stoner? It appears that this was done to implicate me in the disappearance of one Jethro Jefferson, a blacksmith. You may consider me somewhat offended, but that was nothing like the amount of offence I experienced when I met Constable Feeney Upshot, our local copper, a decent lad, kind to his old mum, who nevertheless seemed to feel that he answered to a mysterious board of magistrates, rather than to the law. The magistrates. Who are the magistrates? Some kind of local body? There appears to be no oversight on these people, no circuit judge, and I haven't finished talking yet." Mr. Stoner, his face grey, sank back into his seat. So did Vimes, trying not to catch Sybil's eye in case she laughed. He made his face a mask of calm again and continued, "And it appears, Mr. Stoner, that officially in this parish, goblins are vermin. Rats are vermin, so are mice, and I believe that pigeons and crows may be also. But they don't play the harp, Mr. Stoner. They don't make exquisitely configured pots. And, Mr. Stoner, they do not beg for mercy, although I must say I've seen the occasional mouse attempted by wiggling its nose winsomely, which did indeed lead me to put the hammer down. But I digress. Goblins may be wretched, unhygienic, and badly fed, and in that they are pretty much like the commonality of most of mankind. Where will your magistrates put the ruler, Mr. Stoner? Then again, we don't use a ruler in Ankh-Morpork, because once the goblins are vermin, then the poor are vermin, and the dwarfs are vermin, and the trolls are vermin. She wasn't vermin, and she pleaded not to die." He leaned back and waited for Mr. Stoner to realise that he did, in fact, have the power of speech. When he did so, the clerk dealt with his situation in a true clerkly fashion by ignoring it. "Nevertheless, Mr. Vimes, you are out of your jurisdiction, and, I may say, encouraging Constable Upshot in ways of thinking, and I might say behaviour, that will bode ill for him in his career." The clerk got no further than that because Vimes interrupted with, "What career? He has no career. He's a copper all by himself, except maybe for some pigs. He's a good lad at heart, doesn't scare easy, and he writes with a clear round hand and can spell too, which in my book makes him automatically sergeant material. As for bloody jurisdiction, murder is the crime of crimes. According to the Omnians, it was the 3rd crime ever committed, the 2 being common theft and public indecency. I know of no society anywhere in the world that doesn't consider it a crime to be pursued with vigour. Understand? And as for the law, don't try to talk to me about the law. I am not above the law, but I stand right underneath it and I hold it up. And currently, I work with Mr. Feeney, and we have an accessory to murder in his cell, and justice, not convenience, will be served." "Well done, Sam," said Sybil loyally, giving the small but distinctive clap that people give when they want other people to join in. Mr. Stoner, on the other hand, simply said, "Well done, sir, but nevertheless my instructions are to arrest you. The magistrates have sworn me in as a policeman, you see, and young Upshot has been relieved of his duties." He winced because of the sudden freeze. Vimes stood up and said, "I don't think I'm going to allow you to arrest me today, Mr. Stoner. I dare say Sybil will allow you a cup of tea, should you want it, but I'm going to see Chief Constable Upshot." And he stood up,
unlocked the door, and walked out of the room, out of the hall, and, at a reasonable speed, down to the lock-up. Halfway down, Willikins overtook him, saying, "I couldn't help hearing all that garbage, Commander, on account of how I was listening at the door, as per Section 5 of the Gentleman's Code. What a nerve! You'll need me to watch your back." Vimes shook his head. "I don't think a civilian should get involved, Willikins." Willikins had to run faster because Vimes was speeding up, but he managed to gasp out, "That is a hell of a thing for you to say to me, Commander," and hurried on regardless. Something was going on at the lock-up. It looked to Vimes as though it might be a domestic disturbance, a ruckus, possibly a fracas, or even a free-for-all, in which case it was definitely unlucky for some. A happy thought occurred. Yes, maybe it was an affray, always a useful word, because nobody's quite certain what it means, but it sounds dangerous. Vimes burst out laughing as soon as he saw what was going on. Feeney was standing in front of the lock-up, his face beetroot red and his ancestral truncheon in his hands. Quite possibly, it had already been used on the small mob trying to assault the lock-up, because there was a man lying on the floor, clutching his groin and groaning. However, Vimes's lengthy experience told him that the man's carefully targeted misfortune had a lot to do with Mrs. Upshot, who was in a semicircle of men, all of them ready to jump back as soon as she waved her broomstick at them. "Don't you dare say my lad Feeney ain't a copper. He is a copper, and so is his dad, and his grandad, and his great-granddad before him." She paused for a moment and went on grudgingly. "Pardon me, I tell a lie. He was a criminal, but anyway, that's nearly like being a copper." The broomstick made a whooshing sound as she swung it backwards and forwards. "I know you lot. Some of you is gamekeepers, and some of you is smugglers, and a few of you is bastards, excuse my clatching." By now she had caught sight of Vimes, and pausing only to bring her broomstick down like a mallet on the foot of a man who made a step in the wrong direction, she pointed her finger at Vimes and yelled, "See him? Now he is a gentleman, and also a great copper. You can tell a real copper, like my Henry, God's bless his soul, and Commander Vimes too. Because they've got proper badges, what have been used to open thousands of beer bottles, I dare say. And believe me, one of them would hurt you if they tried to stick it up your nose. The flimsy bits of cardboard you boys is waving makes me laugh. Come any further, Davy Hackett," she said to the nearest man, "and I will shove this broomstick in your ear. Trust me, I will." Vimes scanned the mob, trying to sort out the vile and dangerous from the innocent and stupid, and was about to brush off a fly from his head when he heard the gasp from the crowd, and saw the arrow on the cobbles and Mrs. Upshot looking at her broom falling into two pieces. In theory, Mrs. Upshot should have screamed, but she had been around coppers for a long time, and so, face red, she pointed at the broken broom and said, as only an old mum could say, "That cost half a dollar. They don't go on trees, you know. It wants paying for." Instantly there was the jingle of frantic hands in pockets. One man with great presence of mind removed his hat and coins showered into it. Since many of the coins were dollars and half-dollars snatched in haste, Mrs. Upshot would clearly be self-sufficient in broomsticks for life. But Feeney, who had been simmering, smacked the hat to the ground just as it was proffered. "No, that's like a bribe, Mar. Someone shot at you. I saw the arrow. It came straight out of this lot, right out the middle. Now, I want you to go inside, Ma, because I'm not going to lose you as well as Dad, understand? Damn well get inside the house, Ma. The reason being, the moment you shut the door, I intend to show these gentlemen their manners." Feeney was on fire. If a chestnut had fallen on his head, it would have exploded, and his rage, pure, righteous rage, the kind of rage in which a man might find the idea and the inclination, and above all the stamina, to beat to death everyone around him, was a pant-wetting concern to the befuddled citizens quite outweighing the secondary one, which was that there was at least $6 of anybody's money lying there on the cobbles, and how much of it could they get away with reclaiming? Vimes did not say a word. There was no room to say a word. A word might dislodge the brake that held retribution in check. Feeney's ancestral club over his shoulder looked like a warning from the gods. In his hands it would be sudden death. No one dared run. Of a certainty, to run would be to make yourself a candidate for whistling oaken crushing. Now, perhaps, was the time. "Chief Constable Upshot, may I have a word as one policeman to another?" Feeney turned on Vimes a bleary look, like a man trying to focus from the other end of the universe. One of the outlying men took this as a cue to leg it, and behind the crowd there was a thump, and the voice of Willikin saying, "Oh, I do beg your pardon, Your Grace, but this gentleman stumbled over my feet. "Regrettably, I have very large feet." And, to accompany the apology, Willikins held up a man whose nose would probably look a lot better by the end of next week. All eyes turned to Willikins except those of Vimes, because there in the shadows, keeping his distance from the mob, was that bloody lawyer again. Not with the mob, obviously. A respectable lawyer could not be part of a mob, oh no. He was just there, watching. Feeney glared at the rest of the men, because tripping can come so easily to a man.
"I appreciate your man's assistance, Commander, but this is my manor, if you know what I mean, and I will have my say."
Feeney was panting heavily, but his gaze swept backwards and forwards to find the first man to move, or even look like someone about to move, sometime in the future.
"I am a policeman. Not always a good one, or a clever one, but I am a policeman, and the man in my lock-up is my prisoner, and I'll defend him to the death. And if it's the death of some bastards who stood in front of my old mum with crossbows they didn't know how to use, well, so be it."
He lowered his voice to less than a scream. "Now, I know you, just like my father did, and Grandad too. Well, some of you at least. And I know you ain't as bad as all that." He stopped for a moment, staring.
"What are you doing here, Mr. Stoner? Standing there next to a mob? Have you been making a few pockets jingle?"
"That statement is actionable, young man," said Stoner. Vimes carefully made his way to Stoner and whispered, "I won't say you're pushing your luck, Mr. Stoner, because your luck ran out the moment you set eyes on me." He tapped the side of his nose. "A word to the wise. I've got big feet, too." Oblivious to this, Feeney went on. "What I want you all to know is that a few nights ago, a goblin girl up on the hill was chopped up while she was pleading for her life. That's bad. Very bad. And one reason is that a man who can chop up a goblin girl will chop up your sister one day. But I will help my—" Feeney hesitated and then said, "colleague, Commander Vimes, and I will bring those responsible to justice. And that ain't all, oh dear me, not by a long chalk, because you see, I know, just like you do, that 3 years ago a load of goblins were grabbed in the night and rounded up to be sent down the river. My poor old dad did what he was told and turned a blind eye, but I ain't doing the same thing. I don't know if any of you helped, and right now that don't concern me over much, because folks around here tend to do what they're told, although maybe some of them like doing what they're told more than others." Feeney turned around, making certain that they all knew they were included.
"And I know something else. I know that late yesterday, when we were actually on the way to Hangnails, a bunch of goblins from Overhang were grabbed and put on an oxboat down the river to—"
"What?
Why haven't you told me all this before?" Vimes shouted.
Feeney didn't look in his direction, keeping his gaze on the mob.
"What before? Sorry, Commander, but it's been all go, and I only found out just before this bunch arrived. Since when, it's all got busy. The boat probably came past here while we were still opening barrels and Hangnails. This lot wanted me to hand over our prisoner, and then, of course, my old mum got involved, as it were, and you know it's always difficult when it involves an old mum. I never told anyone to move, did I?"
This was to a man in some distress, who was almost bent double with his hands on his groin.
"I'm very sorry, Chief Constable Upshot, but I really need the privy, if it's all the same to you, please, thanking you so very much."
Vimes looked down at the crouching man and said,
"Oh, dear me, it's you, Mr. Stoner. Willikins, do take him somewhere where he can go about his business, will you? But be sure to bring him back here. And if it turns out that he didn't really need to do any business, do him the courtesy of making sure that he does."
He wanted to say a great deal more at this time, but this was, after all, Feeney's patch, and the lad was surprisingly good at it when it came to pushing people who pushed old mums. And the boy hadn't finished yet. His mood had simply moved from molten steel to cold, hard iron.
"Before I tell you what happens next, gentlemen, I'd like to draw your attention to the goblin sitting up there in the tree watching you all. All you who are locals know Stinky, and you know sometimes you can give him a kick, or sometimes he blags a cigarette off you, and sometimes he runs you a little errand, yes?"
There was a sense of sweating relief among the crowd that the worst appeared to be over. In fact, it had only just begun.
"Commander Vimes would like you to know, and so indeed would I, that the law applies to everybody, and that means it applies to goblins as well."
There was a certain amount of nodding at that, and Feeney continued.
"But if the law applies to goblins, then goblins have rights, and if goblins have rights, then it would be right to have a goblin policeman attached to the Shire force."
Vimes looked at Feeney with amazement and a not inconsiderable amount of admiration. That had got them. They had all been nodding, and he had led them by the nod, and before they knew it they were nodding at a goblin officer. "Well, gentlemen, I'm intending to make Stinky a probationary special constable, just so he can keep me up to date with what's happening on the hill. He'll have a badge, and anyone giving him a kick from now on will be assaulting a police officer in the course of his duty. I think the penalty for doing that is not just being hanged, but also to let you bounce up and down from it afterwards. This is an internal force decision which does not require the authority of any magistrate. Is that not so, Commander Vimes?" Vimes was amazed at how his mouth responded without any reference to his brain. "Yes, Chief Constable Upshot, as per Section 12, Part 3 of the Laws and Ordinances of Ankh-Morpork, generally considered a model for police procedure," he added confidently, knowing that no one present would ever have clapped eyes on them and would quite likely not be able to read them even if they had. Inside, Vimes winced. He'd got away with having dwarfs, trolls, and finally even werewolves and vampires in the watch, albeit on certain obvious conditions, but that had been the result of leverage over the years. Vetinari always said, "What is normal? Normal is yesterday and last week and last month taken together." And Vimes supposed they had slipped things in one at a time to allow normal to gradually evolve. Although Mr. Stinky, or rather, probationary Special Constable Stinky, had really better confine his policing activities to the cave. Yes, not such a bad idea at that. Indeed, if only he could get them to leave chickens alone, maybe Normal would have a chance. After all, people seemed quite easy about having their rights and liberties taken away by those they looked up to, but somehow a space on the perch was a slap in the face and treated as such. And now Feeney, getting out of breath, was nearly talked out. "I can't force any of you to tell me anything, but is there any one of you anxious to help me with my inquiries?" Vimes tried not to let anyone see his expression, least of all Feeney. Of course, Captain Carrot had once been like that, and was it possible maybe even young Sam Vimes had been like that too? But surely anyone could see that you never expect people who are part of a crowd to put up their hand and pipe up, "Yes, Constable, I'd be very happy to tell you everything I know, and I'd like these fine gentlemen here to be my witnesses." What you did do, after a performance like that, was just wait. Wait until somebody sidles up and whispers something when you're alone, or just tilts his head in the right direction, or, and this had happened to Vimes, writes three initials on the spilled beer on a bar top and industriously wipes it clean within 2 seconds. Some bright spark would think, you never know your luck. After all, Feeney could be a coming man, right? And a happy relationship might come in handy one day. Vimes blew away the pink cloud of embarrassment. "Well, gentlemen, speaking as commander of the Ankh-Morpork City Watch, it seems to me that your senior police officer is being considerably lenient with you. I would not be, so be grateful for him. How many of these," and here Vimes inserted a sneer, "gentlemen do you really know, Chief Constable Upshot?" "Oh, about half of them, Commander. That's to say their names, families, home addresses and similar. The rest of them are from other places. I can't say that they're all angels, but they're mostly not too bad." This sensible little speech, in the circumstances, earned Feeney a few smirks and a certain relieved look all round, and happily an opening for Vimes, who said, "So, which one of them had an arrow ready in his crossbow, do you think, Mr. Feeney?" But before Feeney had time to open his mouth, Vimes had spun round to confront the returning Mr. Stoner, whose digestion had let him down. Willikins, whose instincts seldom failed, was still keeping an eye on him. Loudly and cheerfully, Vimes said, "I see that my good friend Mr. Stoner is back, and he's a lawyer and I'm a policeman, and we know how to talk to one another. Do come this way, Mr. Stoner." He grabbed the unwilling lawyer gently but firmly by the arm and led him some way from the crowd, who watched, Vimes was pleased to see, with immediate deep suspicion. "You are a lawyer, are you not, Mr. Stoner? Not a criminal lawyer by any chance?" "No, Your Grace, I specialise mostly in land and property matters." "Are far less dangerous," said Vimes. "And I suppose you're a member of the Ankh-Morpork Bar, presided over by my old chum, Mr. Slant." He said it convivially, but Vimes knew that the name of the old zombie would strike terror into any lawyer's heart, although whether Mr. Slant still had one of his own was questionable. And now Mr. Stoner must be thinking quite quickly. If he had any sense, and read his law journal between the lines, he would be aware that while Mr. Slant would bow, rather stiffly, to the rich and influential, he did not like mistakes, and he did not like seeing the law being brought into disrepute by inept lawyers and laymen, believing that this particular duty should be left to senior lawyers, such as Mr. Slant, who could do it with care and panache, and 300 Ankh-Morpork dollars an hour. And Mr. Stoner should be thinking that, since it appeared that landowners around here had made up the law to suit themselves, which was the prerogative of the legal profession as a whole, Mr. Slant would not be a happy zombie. And, as custom and practice now dictated that he should no longer walk around groaning with his hands held out directly in front of him, one of them perhaps holding a severed head for effect, he was known to vent his still considerable spleen on snotty young lawyers with ideas above their station by talking to them for some time in a calm, low voice, causing them to say afterwards that the severed head was, by contrast, the vegetarian option.